Let's take a journey back to 2003. Canadian teen sensation Avril Lavigne was topping the charts and turning the music industry upside down. But what if I told you that the Avril Lavigne we know and love might not be the same Avril? What? Did Avril die? Was she replaced by a doppelganger? I'm Joanne McNally, and I'm doing a deep dive into a notorious internet conspiracy. Who replaced Avril Lavigne? Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast.
Wellness. Vitamins and supplements.
Ozempic and Wegovy.
The detox diet.
You sweat out the toxins.
I eat more than bone broth and vegetables.
I always like try and get a little bit of meditating in.
Try out cryotherapy.
Corporate wellness company.
Any kind of skincare, any kind of self-care.
But I take it almost regularly.
No wonder your skin looks great.
Intermittent fasting is having a bit of a moment. These diets have been touted as an easy and fast way to lose weight. Some people claim that there are added benefits like lower cholesterol, stronger immunity, even better skin. One doctor who had long been an advocate of intermittent fasting decided to conduct his own study, and the results of that study surprised him. Ethan Weiss is a cardiologist, volunteer professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, and he joins us as part of our series on wellness, well-founded. Ethan, good morning.
Good morning.
How do you define what this is, intermittent fasting? It's a phrase that people see. It gets tossed around a lot, influencers, podcasts, in newspapers. What is it?
All animals intermittent fast to some degree. You know, as human beings in the modern world, we all fast when we're sleeping. So typically an average human being is eating for 12 to 14 hours a day and fasting for the rest of the time. Intermittent fasting is really defined by extending that period of fasting beyond what is normal or natural, I guess is probably the better way to put it. And some degree of fasting has been practiced for quite a while in human history. The most common form is this time-restricted eating, which is defined by fasting for some period of time. And the most common form of that is 16 hours of fasting and 8 hours of eating.
This is the 16-8 method.
Yep.
And there's different ratios, right, in terms of what you would do over the course of a week. Like there's the 5-2 diet.
Yeah, there are different ratios both within a day. So there are some people who will fast for even longer than 16 hours. Some people fast for 18, 20. And then there are different ratios for within a week. So like you say, 5-2 is a common one where people are fasting for 2 days a week and then eating for five. And then there are even more extreme versions of intermittent fasting where people fast for very prolonged periods of time, up to weeks at a time, and then eat in between.
How did this become a thing? I mean, because people, to your point, people have been fasting naturally, perhaps for a long time, but this is something else. What was going on?
I think, and I haven't done a sort of careful historical deep dive, but the way I got interested, I think, is probably similar to the way most people who are loosely paying attention got interested, which is came on the heels of multiple different articles and pieces in popular press describing the results of a bunch of intermittent fasting. At that time, it was called time-restricted feeding experiments done in mice. Those were published in 2010-ish, and they all showed that the animals who were fed the same amount of food but were only allowed to eat it during a certain period of time during the day ended up healthier, leaner, and less metabolic disease than those allowed to eat all the time, or what we call ad lib.
And so for us humans, I mean, what are proponents saying that the benefit of fasting for 16 hours a day is? Is it weight loss, or is there something else that's going on there as well?
There were no human clinical trials examining the benefits. There was a lot of anecdotal evidence, a lot of stories, and also interject that losing weight for a short period of time is relatively easy. Keeping weight off for a long period of time is very difficult. And so these short-term weight loss trials are not that informative because you can do almost anything and lose weight for a short period of time. But I guess the bottom line for me is that the amount of weight that is lost, number of kilograms or percent of the body weight that's lost, is really modest.
Tell me about your own experience with this. Why did you want to start intermittent fasting? What was the way into this for you?
So it really did come out as a result of my reading these papers that got a lot of attention, both in the popular press and also in the scientific literature, that really looked like this magic bullet that would allow people to improve their metabolic health and lose a lot of weight, not by doing anything that would require any fancy math or any devices or any special diets. You could eat exactly the same things that you would eat normally. But if you just restricted the amount of time that you ate, in this case, really, you'd skip breakfast, that you'd potentially lose a bunch of weight and have an improvement in your overall metabolic health. And I got very captivated by this and started practicing it myself. And I even went so far as to make recommendations to friends, family, and even patients of mine to do this, because it just seemed so easy. And anecdotally, even for me, it worked, quote unquote, right? I lost a few pounds and felt better. And ultimately, after doing it for a few years, I started to wonder, what is the actual evidence that supports doing this in human beings? Are there any trials that show that this is beneficial in a human being? We can say with certainty that mice and humans are very different, particularly when it comes to their metabolism. Mice are tiny and have a very high metabolic rate. So a fast in a mouse that lasts for a day would be the equivalent of something like 7 days in a human being. So
having done your own research in the wake of, as you said, you practicing this, but also recommending it to friends and family and patients, what did you find coming into that research?
We're very fortunate to be able to get the funding and have the resources to put together a interventional clinical trial. We also did a very short-term study. It was really a pilot designed to be 12 weeks long. And we designed it so that you would be assigned randomly to one of two potential interventional arms. We were intentionally trying to be a little bit obtuse about what was the actual intervention and what we were testing. We didn't want subjects of the research to know what it was we felt like was going to work, what was better. So we called one arm time-restricted eating. The other one, I think we called something like balanced eating. Mm. And so for the time-restricted eating arm, all we did was tell people, and we'd used an app for this. We gave people, you know, sort of a notification when their eating window was open, which was at noon, and then when it closed at 8. And we just told them they could do whatever they want in between 12 and 8, eat as much or as little as they want, and that between 8 p.m. and 12, they really should only have water, or we allowed them to have black coffee or tea. And then the balanced arm, we, again, with the intent of not being deceptive, but making them believe that there was something of potentially a benefit to them, we asked them to eat during windows that we made up. Breakfast was, say, between 5 and 9. Lunch was between, you know, 11 and 2. And dinner was between, say, 5 and 9.
So what was the difference? When those people go through the human trial, what did you find in comparing those two groups?
We looked at many hundred different outcomes and variables, but the primary outcome was weight loss. We mailed everybody a digital scale and asked them to step on it and connected that through their smartphones so we could look at the data. And the bottom line was, at the end of the trial, there was no statistical difference between the two groups. Both groups lost a little bit of weight, a kilogram or a couple of kilograms at most, but there was no difference between the two groups. And then I think what was most interesting about it was that we looked at each individual and how much weight they lost during the 12 weeks. And what you can see when you look at this is that they look really similar. And in fact, the person who lost the most weight was assigned to the control group.
You said that you found the findings hard to accept.
You know, as scientists are taught or hope to believe that we're unbiased and that we're just testing hypotheses, but obviously we're not. And I went into this one with a belief that this was going to be an impactful and important way to help people lose weight and improve their metabolic health. And so we were very surprised, and I would say even disappointed. And in fact, I had a wonderful graduate student who was working on this, who was basically leading this study, and he would email me after we'd finished the study and send it off to the statisticians for analysis. He'd email me results, and over the course of weeks, I would say, well, that's not right. Send it back and do it again. And we did that, like, you know, four different times. And finally, after a while, it was clear to me and to him and to everybody else that there was just no difference. It didn't matter how we looked at it, there was just no difference. And that was quite a shock. And so then we looked at all these other things I mentioned, body composition, so how much fat do you lose? How much muscle mass do you lose? What happened to people's activity? We measured all kinds of blood markers. We looked at what happened to their lipids, their cholesterol. And the bottom line was there was really almost no difference between the two groups. The one exception, and this was very exploratory and was not pre-specified, so it wasn't anything that I was going to say, oh, well, this is definitely something to worry about. Typically, when people lose weight in whatever intervention it is, whether it's through diet, whether it's through exercise or taking a, you know, a medicine like one of the new GLP-1 receptor agonists, you lose both lean mass, which is mostly muscle, and fat mass. And the ratio of how much you lose is pretty well established, and it's pretty similar across the board. That is, if you lose a kilogram of weight, about a third of that's going to come from muscle and two-thirds will come from fat. And what we saw in this experiment was that the ratios got flipped. It looked like people were losing more muscle mass relative to the amount of fat mass, which seemed really not at all what you'd want, right? If anything, you'd want it to be the same or more. You really optimized for losing fat mass. So we were surprised by that and thought that was interesting and probably worth further study. Again, I wouldn't make any conclusions around that. It just looked like it was interesting and worth exploring.
Given how popular this is, did you face any pushback when
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. It was funny because I was a fierce advocate for this thing, making recommendations to friends, family, patients, everyone, doing it myself. And, you know, based on the results of these data that we didn't expect and quite frankly didn't really like, I changed my practice. And I felt like the responsible thing to do was to tell the story the way it happened. And I think, you know, it's fair to say, having been in and around nutrition for a long period of time, that there are very, very strong feelings. And when something comes that flies in the face of those beliefs, they can react quite negatively. Mm. So that I did get a huge amount of pushback and actually continue to today, now even almost, you know, 4 years later.
Is there any risk with time-restricted eating? The Heart Association in the United States put out an abstract last month, said there could be a link between it and fasting and a higher risk of heart disease, for example.
Yeah, that abstract has gotten a lot of attention. Of course, the majority of the attention was generated by people who are advocates of time-restricted eating. Mm-hmm. And they, well, I'm going to be completely honest, I haven't really even read the abstract. I haven't paid a lot of attention to it. In my view, I don't think there are tremendous risks to time-restricted eating, other than the potential that there may be an impact on the loss of lean mass. And there are biological and biologically plausible reasons why that might be. The thing to me that made me stop doing it was just that it didn't appear that it was actually doing much.
I mean, food is a lot of different things. It's fuel, but it's also a source of joy, right? It brings people together. You sit down, you break bread, you get pleasure from eating something. What would you say in the face of that? What would you say to somebody who is considering doing this?
The reason it's so interesting is that it's easy. And if you're telling people that they can only eat between 6 and 2 and they're going to have to sit at the dinner table with their family and just have a glass of water, that's not very easy. And so we made the decision for the purpose of our study, we chose to study the opposite, the late time restricted eating where you're fasting during the day. I have patients of mine, you know, living in San Francisco, you can imagine there are people who embrace lots of different, I don't want to call them fringe, but lots of different ways of living.
You said it, not nutrition. Me, but yes, continue. Yep.
I have patients who fast for many days at a time. And at one point, one of them told me, I think quite non-ironically, that there were a group of them that would go out to dinner and like at least 75 or 80% of the people at the table were fasting. It sounded dreadful, right? As you say, you go out to dinner. I just went out to dinner last night with friends and that's meant to be a social experience. And I can only imagine how unfun that would be if you had to sit there and just watch.
Especially if there's no evidence that sitting there and watching, to your point, actually does much of anything.
That makes it even worse. Yep.
Ethan Weiss, good to talk to you about this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ethan Weiss is a cardiologist, volunteer professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.